Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Job chapter 38, going to do verses 1 through 41. I will call this chapter, The Lord Answers Job, Part 1. He's going to continue, the Lord is, in the next chapter, answering Job. Now, we have, at this stage of the piece, a bunch of unhappy campers. We've got Job is unhappy because he's lost all of his money, his children, his wife is said to curse God and die. He thinks God has abandoned him. He's been complaining to God. God won't answer him as to why he's going through all the suffering. He knows it's not because of any sin that he's done. So Job is unhappy, of course. His three false friends are unhappy because they think Job has caused just judgment to fall on his head because of some unconfessed sin that Job had done before the calamity fell on his head in order to cause the calamity to fall. Now, the fourth false friend, Elihu, he is a little more ambiguous as to about what he's upset with. He thinks that Job has sinned, but it could have been he thought that, like the other three false friends, that Job sinned in order to call the suffering to come on his head, or it could be that he has sinned in questioning God. It could be that Elihu thinks that Job has not done anything to cause the calamity to fall, or if he has, Elihu is agnostic about it, doesn't know, but he does know that Job is not treating God properly when he demands a hearing from God and when he speaks so angrily toward God. But we'll just sum up all the unhappiness with the four false friends by saying this. They think that Job has sinned. Now, we're going to listen to God now, and we're going to see that God is not happy with Job for demanding an answer as to why he's suffering. In fact, God never really answers the question. But he puts Job in his place, and he basically says, I'm God, you're not. Don't question me about the suffering. And then God is later on is also going to condemn the unjust friends for blaming Job for something that Job hasn't done. So that's our context. We start now in Job 38, verses 1 through 3. Then the Lord answered Job from the whirlwind. He said, Who is this who obscures my counsel with ignorant words? Get ready to answer me like a man. When I question you, you will inform me. Now, God is said to answer Job from the whirlwind in verse 1. We might ask, exactly how was God speaking to Job? Here's what the NIV Study Bible says. In the Old Testament, we have accounts of God appearing to humans in a visible or audible manner. To some, God appeared in angelic or human form. To Moses, God appeared in a burning bush. Here, God speaks to Job out of a storm, because in the last chapter of Job, we read that God spoke to three of the four friends. We can assume that God spoke to Job in an audible voice that could be heard by everyone present. And I think that's probably the right answer. Now, what is this whirlwind? John Gill suggests that perhaps Elihu had alluded to an arising storm when he was making his speech, and that's the whirlwind that God is answering Job from. In Elihu's last speech in Job 37, verse 2, Elihu had said this, Listen closely to the thunder of his voice and the rumbling that goes out from his mouth. Elihu had used the imagery of storms to talk about God being angry at Job. So if Gill is right there, then there was an actual whirlwind, a tempest that came up. And that wouldn't surprise me because God often speaks from storms and tempests. Think of God speaking to Moses on Mount Sinai. A whirlwind is a symbol of judgment, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown point out. We read in Psalms 50, verses 3 through 4, May our God come and not keep silence. Fire devours before him, and it is very tempestuous around him. He summons the heavens above and the earth to judge his people. It is very tempestuous around him. That's a storm, and God often speaks through storms. So that would make sense that God is answering Job from the whirlwind. It gives more dramatic effect that God is not exactly happy with Job. Now in verse 2, God says, Who is this who obscures my counsel? The verse doesn't say who God is speaking to. I think it's obvious he's speaking to Job, but it could be Elihu. Gill denies that. I don't think that's what it is. He's talking to Job. Get ready to answer me like a man. Stand up and take it like a man. I like that verse 3 there. Who is this who obscures my counsel? What does that mean? Well, as Gill and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, that what God means there is that, Job, you're making my words confusing. The NIV translates this as, who darkens my counsel? Who obscures my counsel? In other words, I speak, and now you're confusing things, Job. You keep demanding that I give you a reason why you're suffering. I don't have to give you any reason at all. Now, here's what the NIV Study Bible says about this complaint of God about Job darkening his counsel. Quote, "In the bitterness of his pain and discomfort, Job had expressed rage over the injustice he was experiencing. He claimed that God was angry with him and had become his enemy. From the events in the prologue, the reader knows that these assumptions were false. Job's biggest problem was his ignorance. He could not comprehend the complexity of God or the world he had created. And basically what he couldn't understand is that the devil had been turned loose on him in order to prove that Job still had a faithful heart." Now, one of the things that has always puzzled me is, why didn't God just tell Job that? The reason that you suffered was because the devil was testing you. I don't know why he didn't. Now, there's another option as to how we can interpret verse 2. Who is this who obscures my counsel? The "my" is in brackets. It's not in the original text, so you could read it this way. Who is this who obscures counsel with ignorant words? In other words, who is this to speak in such ignorant words? Job's words were ignorant. In both cases, Job's words are ignorant, but in the first option, his ignorant words are confusing God's words, his counsel. The second option, he's just confusing things in general. He's not obscuring God's counsel. He's just obscuring counsel in general. Leave that "my" out, which is not in the original text, which would mean that Job's were confusing, as Gill put it. They were delivered in such an obscure manner as not to be intelligible by those who heard them. So option number one, Job is making God unintelligible, and option number two, Job is unintelligible. I think it's option number one. I think God is making, Job is making God out to be something he's not, and that is not going to be stood for by God. We go now to Job 38, verses 4 through 7. God continues speaking to Job, "Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me, if you have understanding, who set its measurements, since you know? Or who stretched the line on it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy?" Now, let me read the NIV Study Bible's introduction to this, their introduction to God's speeches. Quote, "In all that God says in his speeches, God makes no reference to Job's troubles or even to the reason why he was suffering. In the divine speeches, God demonstrates that he is all-powerful and all-loving and leaves the paradox unresolved. He never really answers Job's charges." I just said that, and I still have a question. Is why didn't he? I don't know. "But neither does God reverse his opinion," the NIV Study Bible continues. "Neither does God reverse his opinion that Job is blameless. In the end, God stands by Job and rebukes his friends, leaving their sentence in the hands of the man they have been accusing. Job, in his righteousness, forgives those who accused him unjustly and prays for them. God gave Job a degree of vindication, but only after he no longer demanded it." Only after Job no longer demanded it. So that gives a good introduction of what we're going to see in the last five chapters of Job as we continue. Now, in verse 5, God says, "Who set its measurements?" That means the measurements of the earth. Obviously, God created the earth. Job, you didn't. So who are you to question me? "Who set its measurements, since you know?" Now, there's a translation issue here. Other translations don't translate it, "since you know." They translate it as "if you know." KJV, Holman Christian Study Bible, "if you know." That has always bugged me. I noticed when I studied a little bit of Greek, I always had trouble. Is this "if" or "since"? And it was always, it's always "if," it's always "if." But sometimes the meaning is "since." It's not always "if." Sometimes there's a word for "since," but there's a word for "if" that really means "since." And it's always confusing. Well, we have the same issue here in translation. The NASB says, "Since you know, Job, who set its measurements?" Well, that sounds sarcastic. And many people think that is sarcastic. I think it's sarcastic. "Since you know, Job, since you know so much." If you take it straight, it will be, well, who set its measurements if you know Job? Well, why would God be asking Job if he knew about the measurements of the earth? I think that's obvious sarcasm. Who stretched the line on it? The line, as the NIV puts it, is a measuring line. I used to help my father build houses, work construction, and when you work construction, you are always stretching lines to measure things. So this is a construction metaphor. Who made the earth? God did. You didn't, Job. On what were the bases or the foundations or the footings? NIV has footings. Holman Christian Study Bible has foundations. NASB has bases. On what were its foundations sunk? Again, the construction metaphor. Who laid its cornerstone? God did. I did. Not you, Job. Verse 7, when the morning stars sang together. in the morning. It's especially beautiful. The stars are beautiful in the morning. It's appropriate they are mentioned here since God is talking about the dawn, the morning of creation. Now, what are these stars? Well, I suspect they're literal stars, because is it not true that the heavens declare the handiwork of God? That famous passage. We read also in Psalm 19:1, the heavens are telling of the glory of God. I think that is the verse I was referring to. The heavens are telling of the glory of God, and their expanse is declaring the work of his hands. The stars speak to us. Look at me. Had to be somebody pretty great that would make something as pretty as a star. Psalm 148:3, praise him, sun and moon. Praise him, all stars of light. So you see, the stars are actually speaking, metaphorically, poetically, but they're speaking and they're telling of the glory of God. Some people suggest that the morning stars are angels who sang together at the dawn of creation, putting stars in parallel with all the sons of God shouting for joy at the end of verse 7. I don't think so. I think it's talking about literal stars. But I do think the sons of God is referring to angels. They are sons of God by creation, not by birth as Jesus was, not by adoption as Christians are. We're sons of God too, but not in the way angels are. Angels are created, and so therefore they're the sons of God. The NIV translates sons of God as angels. They do put a note that says that the Hebrew means the sons of God, so they point out to you that's an interpretation, but I think that's reasonable. So the stars sing and the angels sing when God made. Were you there, Job, to see that? We go now to verses 8 through 11, Job 38. God continues speaking to Job. Or who enclosed the sea with the doors when bursting forth? It went out from the womb. The sea went out from the womb. When I made a cloud its garment, a cloud the garment of the sea, and thick darkness its swaddling band. Thick darkness is the swaddling band of the sea. And I placed boundaries on the sea and set a bolt in doors. And I said, thus far you shall come, but no farther. And here shall your proud waves stop. Verse 8, who enclosed the sea with doors? As Gill puts it, quote, the bowels of the earth being the storehouses where God first laid up the deep waters. So think about the water under the earth, and then the earthquake and the earth splits and water comes barreling out, just like happened at Noah's flood, for example. So that's the idea of the sea bursting forth from the womb, like a kid bursts forth from his mother's womb. The water of the oceans burst forth from the enclosing land. As in Psalm 33:7, God gathers the waters of the sea together as a heap. He lays up the deeps in storehouses. Now the sea is said in verse 9 to be banded with a swaddling band. In the first part of verse 9, God made a cloud the garment of the sea. So if you think about the sea covered with clouds, and then think about the sea at nighttime when it's totally dark and darkness surrounds the sea, that's the picture we have here. The swaddling band is translated in the NIV this way, and God wrapped it, the sea, God wrapped the sea in thick darkness. Think about Genesis 1:2. The earth was formless and void, and darkness was over the surface of the deep. And the Spirit of God was moving over the surface of the water. So darkness was over the deep. Notice that these verses carry forth a metaphor of the birth of a child. Bursting forth, the sea went out from the womb, like a child does. When I made a cloud its garment, and in thick darkness its swaddling band. So the baby, or the earth in this case, the sea in this case, is covered with clothes, is wrapped in clothes like a baby is when he's swaddled. Verse 10, and I placed boundaries on it. Now, the birthing metaphor probably stops there. You could say babies are given boundaries, but no, it stopped there. How does God place a boundary on the sea? Well, to keep the oceans from running all over the earth and drowning everything. There were mountains that stopped the sea. I live in South Carolina, and I've gone to the sea, gone to the ocean every year for all of my life. And when I was a little kid, I used to look at that big body of water, and I used to think, well, what makes it stop right here? Because if it just keeps going, it will wash over our house and drown me. And for years, and I think everybody who goes to the beach has these kind of dreams, I would dream about the waves getting higher and higher. They come over the sand dunes, then they come over the road, then they start rising. Then the next thing you know, they're through the screen porch, and then the water is running through the house. And then I look down, and my little red Toyota station wagon has been lifted up and carried on down the road as the sea keeps going over, the ocean keeps going over the roads and into the creek at the back. What makes it stop? Well, actually, that's a complex issue, a complex scientific issue, and I don't understand it, but I do know that roughly, and sometimes the beach goes out, the beach comes in, they got to pour sand in, and it affects people down the beach, and, you know, there's a lot of stuff that goes into this, but basically, God puts the oceans where he wants the oceans and the continents where he wants the continents so people can live on them, because the earth was made by God for people. Were you there, Job, when I placed these said boundaries on the sea? A set of bolting doors. In other words, you're not coming through this door, see? It's padlocked. Your proud waves are going to stop. Were you there, Job? We go now to Job 38, verses 12 through 13. God continues speaking to Job. Have you ever in your life commanded the morning and caused the dawn to know its place, that it might take hold of the ends of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it? So God makes the sun rise every morning and creates the dawn. Job, you can't do that. What does he mean? What does God mean when he says, Job, have you ever shaken the wicked out of the earth? What does it mean to shake the wicked out of the earth? Well, as John Gill explains it, evil people do evil at night. They have to run out of the night into hiding when day comes. That's how God shakes the wicked out of the earth. He lets the sun come up, and the sun shines on the evil men, and the evil men run and hide. And so wicked people are shaken out of the earth at night when they're out there doing their bad stuff. God shakes them out of it by forcing them to go hide. As Adam Clark puts it, as soon as the light begins to dawn upon the earth, thieves, assassins, murderers, and adulterers, who all hate and shun the light, fly like ferocious beasts to their several dens and hiding places. We go now to Job 38, 14 through 15. God continues speaking to Job. The earth is changed as clay is by a seal. Its hills stand out like the folds of a garment. Light is withheld from the wicked, and the arm raised in violence is broken. The earth is changed as clay is by a seal. If you think about a seal, if you press it into clay, of course, it'll change the clay from being flat into a picture of a king or a picture of something. The NIV translates this as the earth takes shape like clay under a seal. The next part of verse 14 says the earth's hills stand out like the folds of a garment. If you look at a garment that's folded, that's an easy metaphor. It looks like hills that are rising out of the flat earth as the earth is folded, and the hills make folds in the earth. Verse 15, light is withheld from the wicked. The NIV translates that as the wicked are denied their light. Light can stand for prosperity, it can stand for life, so God judges the wicked. Now that confirms what both Job and his false friends all said. God judges the wicked, Job. You must be wicked because you're suffering. Well, no, that wasn't true, but in general, God does. He does judge the wicked, and God affirms that right here. It just doesn't mean he guides the wicked all the time right now. It might be you have to wait until the final assize, the final judgment at the end of time when God finally judges the wicked. You might have to wait till then, but if you include eternity with temporal events on earth, God indeed judges all the wicked. But just as a general statement, who can deny what God is saying here? Light, God withholds light from the wicked. And the arm raised in violence, that's the wicked man about to stab somebody or to shoot somebody, whatever, and the arm raised in violence is broken. God breaks the arm of the wicked. I love these verses because there's so many wicked people running the American government right now. I mean, they're evil. God's going to break their arms. I can't wait. I can't wait till that day. We go now to Job 38, verses 16 through 18. God continues speaking to Job. Job, have you entered into the springs of the sea or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been revealed to you, or have you seen the gates of deep darkness? Have you understood the expanse of the earth? Tell me if you know all this. Have you entered the springs of the sea? That would be water gushing up from the ocean floor. We've already mentioned that. Have you walked in the recesses of the deep? That means the deep part of the ocean. You ever walked down there? Miles deep? I don't think so. Verse 17, Job, have the gates of death been revealed to you? As the NIV Study Bible says here, in ancient literature of the Mesopotamian area, all who entered the netherworld after death passed through a series of seven gates. That's probably what God's referring to, Job, because that was be the way that Job looked at getting to the underworld, getting to Sheol. Have the gates of death been revealed to you? Of course not. Job's never been dead. Or have you seen the gates of deep darkness? The gates of deep darkness are probably the same thing as the gates of death, being placed in parallel with the gates of death. John Gill holds it that way, and I do too. Some other translations, the NIV and the KJV says, have you seen the gates of the shadow of death instead of deep darkness? That's nice. But at any rate, the idea is, Job, no, you haven't seen that. Only I can see that. Verse 18, Job, have you understood the expanse of the earth? As John Gill paraphrases, hast thou gone over the whole face of the earth and measured it, all its parts, its hills and dales, rocks and mountains, and took a survey of all the cities, towns and villages, woods, forests, fountains, rivers, etc.? And the answer to that rhetorical question is, of course, no, you haven't, Job. Tell me, Job, if you know all this. God finishes up verse 18. Come on, Job, let me hear you. Ooh, this is a little rough for Job. Now remember, Job is scratching his boils. He's lost all his property and his family. His servants have been killed. He's in utter misery. He's been abandoned by his wife and his friends. And now God's getting on his case. Whew. Job 38, verses 19 through 21. Where is the road to the home of light, Job? Do you know where darkness lives, so you can lead it back to its border? Are you familiar with the paths to its home? Don't you know? You were already born. You have lived so long. Verse 19 and verse 20. God is asking Job, does he understand light and darkness? Well, it's interesting. Scientists even today don't understand light. Some of them say it's particles. Some of them say it's waves. Some of them say it's both. Some of them say we don't know. I don't know if that will ever be solved in my lifetime. Probably won't be. But back then, in the second millennium B.C., Job sure didn't understand it. He didn't know where light came from. He didn't know where darkness comes from. He didn't know the border between light and dark. And then in verse 21, God says, don't you know? Now, there's a couple of ways you can read that. God is being sarcastic again. You were already born. You were already born when light and darkness was created. That was in Genesis, right? You were already born then. You have lived so long, all the way since the creation of the world, that you would know all this. Now, God is being sarcastic, I believe. Now, there's another option. You can take it straight that God just asked Job straightforward, in a straightforward manner. Don't you know, Job? You know, Job. You weren't living back then, but I don't think so. I think he's being a little sarcastic. However, as the NIV Study Bible says, God is not working to embarrass Job by being sarcastic. He's trying to instruct him. Now, the NIV translation and the NASB translation makes the phrase at the first part of verse 21, don't you know, instead of being a question mark as the Holman Christian Study Bible, they make it a statement. The NIV says, surely you know, Job. Surely you know. Job 38:21, and the NASB says, you know, for you were born then. And that would have to, of course, be sarcastic because Job obviously doesn't know where darkness and light came from. Well, Clark agrees with me that this is sarcasm. He says, this is another strong and biting irony, and the literal translation proves it. Thou knowest, because thou was then born, and the number of thy days is great. Yeah, that's sarcastic. And interestingly enough, God is being sarcastic here. There's lots of places, for example, the Apostle Paul was sarcastic. There's lots of places of sarcasm in the Bible. I remember one time I used some sarcasm in an article, and I realized that sarcasm can be wrongly used. But in this particular case, I was dealing with some heretics, and so I felt perfectly justified in using the sarcasm. And I could not believe how many people emailed me and said, how dare you be sarcastic? You're a Christian. And that made me start thinking. I went back and found a bunch of places where Paul was sarcastic. I wish they would mutilate themselves. You know, come on. Some things need to have sarcasm leveled at it. For example, when people today say that men can be pregnant and have children, that's the latest thing regurgitated from the bowels of the radical left these days, men can be pregnant. No, that calls for sarcasm. That calls for the Babylon Bee to get busy, because people who are saying stuff like that are fools. We go now to Job 38, verses 22 through 27. God continues speaking to Job. Have you entered the storehouses of the snow, or have you seen the storehouses of the hail, which I have reserved for the time of distress, for the day of war and battle? Where is the way that the light is divided, or the east wind scattered on the earth? Who has cleft a channel for the flood, or a way for the thunderbolt, to bring rain on a land without people, on a desert without a man in it, to satisfy the waste and desolate land, and to make the seeds of grass to sprout? Now, there's two things in these six verses dealing with the elements, dealing with weather. How God uses the weather to deal with people who are fighting wars, and how God uses the weather to deal with the places on the earth which man has not cultivated. In verse 22, God says, Job, have you entered the storehouses of the snow? Now, there's no instance of snow falling on armies in battle in the scripture, as John Gill points out, but it has happened in history before. Think of Hitler trying to march on Moscow and the snow falling on his armies and destroying it. How about Napoleon doing the same thing? Two of my least favorite people, Hitler and Napoleon. had snow dumped on them and it ruined them. Ha ha! Well, who's in charge of the snow? Who's in charge of the storehouses of the snow? It's time to open the doors of the storehouses of the snow and dump it on the bad guys. Job, have you seen those storehouses? Have you seen the storehouses of the hail? Now, hail in the scriptures is used as a weapon of God to accomplish God's purposes in judgment. Let me briefly read to you six of such scriptures. Exodus 9:25, the hail struck all that was in the field through all the land of Egypt, both man and beast. The hail also struck every plant of the field and shattered every tree of the field. That was one of the plagues of Egypt. Revelation 16:21, and huge hailstones, about 100 pounds each, came down from heaven upon men. And men blasphemed God because of the plague of the hail, because its plague was extremely severe. Joshua 10:10-11, and the Lord confounded them before Israel, and he slew them with a great slaughter at Gibeon, and pursued them by the way of the ascent of Beth-horon, and struck them as far as Azekah and Makkedah. And they fled from before Israel while they were at the descent of Beth-horon. The Lord threw large stones from heaven on them as far as Azekah, and they died there. There were more who died from the hailstones than those whom the sons of Israel killed with the sword. Isaiah 28:17, I will make justice the measuring line and righteousness the level. Then hail will sweep away the refuge of lies. Psalm 18:12-13, from the brightness before him passed his thick clouds, hailstones and coals of fire. The Lord also thundered in the heavens, and the Most High uttered his voice, hailstones and coals of fire. Haggai 2:17, I smote you in every work of your hands with blasting wind, mildew, and hail. Yet you did not come back to me, declares the Lord. So hail is an obvious instrument and symbol of judgment from God. And God is telling Job, back here in Job chapter 38, have you seen where I keep the hail to do all this? Now God talks about how he's used the weather to bring crops on places where God has not cultivated the earth. Verse 24, where is the way that the light is divided? That's the NASB translation. John Gill says that means where light is divided into day and night. The NIV says, what is the way to the place where the lightning is dispersed? Instead of light, it's lightning. I think lightning is better because lightning goes with the east wind, the channel of the flood of waters from heaven for a thunderbolt. All of that is coming up. So I think the context makes it lightning. So have you been there, Job, where the lightning separates from the cloud and heads to the earth? Have you been there, Job, when the east wind was scattered on the earth? Of course, an east wind back then would be coming off the desert, hot as fire. Verse 25, who has cleft a channel for the flood? The NIV says, who has cleft a channel for the torrents of rain? In other words, a channel that gets the rain from heaven down to earth. That's God doing that. Who has cleft a channel? Who has cleft a way for the thunderbolt? God's also got to bring the thunderbolt from the heavens to the earth. All of that natural stuff is done in verse 26 to bring rain on a land without people, where people are not there to cultivate, on a desert without a man in it, to satisfy the waste and desolate land, and to make the seeds of grass to sprout. I'm taking care of the whole earth, Job. You ever done that before? We go now to Job chapter 38, verses 28 through 30. Has the rain a father? Or who has begotten the drops of dew? God continues speaking to Job. From whose womb has come the ice and the frost of heaven? Who has given it birth? Water becomes hard like stone, and the surface of the deep is imprisoned. Verse 28, has the rain a father? Rhetorical question. Obvious answer is no. The rain does not have a father, because God is the father. It means, does the rain have a human father? Like you, Job, you're a mere human. Who has begotten the drops of dew? Well, dew doesn't have a human father. God does that. From whose womb has come the ice? Verse 29. Mothers produce life from their womb. They give birth to things. Well, who gave birth to the ice? There's no mother that gave birth to the ice. God did that. The frost of heaven, who has given it birth? Same thing. God gave birth to the frost of heaven. No mother did that. Verse 30, water became hard like stone. That's when the water freezes, so God can make hail and sleet and snow. The surface of the deep is imprisoned. That's when the surface of the water freezes. God did all that, the workings of nature. You didn't, Job. Job chapter 38, verse 31. Job, can you bind the chains of the Pleiades or loose the cords of Orion? Now here God is referring to the constellations, Pleiades and Orion. Can you bind the chains of the Pleiades? Well, what is the chains? Well, there's a translation issue here. If we Take the translation as, can you bind the chains of the Pleiades? I suppose that just means, can you bind a constellation of the stars and capture it for your own use? Well, let's look at the other translations that are possible. The NIV says, can you bind the beautiful Pleiades? The KJV says, can you bind the sweet influences of Pleiades? If the KJV is right, John Gill says, this constellation of the seven stars, which is meant rising in the spring, this is a spring constellation, Pleiades, the pleasantness of the season, as the word may be rendered, may be intended here, which cannot be restrained or hindered from taking place in the proper course of the year. In other words, can you stop the sweet pleasantness of the Pleiades from arising every spring? The NIV note says that an alternate translation is the twinkling. Can you bind the twinkling of the Pleiades? Can you stop the seven stars of the Pleiades from twinkling when it's time for them to twinkle? Well, anyway, I'm not sure how you translate it, but it's obvious what God means is you can't deal with the Pleiades. I can because I'm God. Job, can you loose the cords of Orion? Now, the Pleiades, the seven stars, they appeared in the spring, but Orion is seen in November and December. And, of course, in November and December, that's when you have stormy weather. Now, what are the cords of Orion? Well, if we listen to Jameson Foster and Brown describe who Orion was, we'll see. Those commentators say that in Hebrew, Orion means the fool. He appears fettered with bands. The old legend represented this star as a hero who presumptuously rebelled against God and was therefore a fool and was chained in the sky as a punishment. For its rising is at the stormy period of the year. He is Nimrod, the exceedingly impious rebel among the Assyrians. He is Orion among the Greeks. Sabaism, worship of the heavenly host, and hero worship were blended in his person. He first subverted the patriarchal order of society by substituting a chieftainship based on conquest. All right, so Hebrew, the fool, he appears fettered with bands. Can you loose those bands, Job? Of course you can't. We go now to Job 38, verses 32 through 33. God continues, can you lead forth a constellation in its season, Job, and guide the bear with her satellites? Do you know the ordinances of the heavens or fix their rule over the earth? So God is still talking about constellations here. That word that's translated constellation in the NASB in the NIV margin is rendered as the morning star. I think the KJV has it too as the morning star. I don't remember. Don't have it written down. The morning star, of course, is Polaris, that star in the north that you always know is up north. So sailors always look at it to know where they are, going north or south. But at any rate, Job, you can't deal with the constellation and tell the constellation where it's supposed to be in whatever season it's in. Can you guide the bear? That's another constellation. The bear, also named as Leo, also known as Ursa Major, the Great Bear. Let's talk about that a little bit. This is from a website called Arthropolis. I don't know whether it's right or not, but it sounds like it's correct. It says that the name Arctic comes from the Greek word Arctos, A-R-K-T-O-S, which means bear. It refers to the constellation Ursa Major, the name Arctic does, or Great Bear, which appears in the northern sky. In other words, the Great Bear is in the north, and the north is over, the northern sky is over the cold expanses of the north, so we're going to call the cold north the Arctic. The Big Dipper is part of the Great Bear constellation, and it guides the way to the North Star, an important navigational guide when you're facing Polaris. You are always facing north. All right, enough of astronomy here. Now in verse 33, God asked Job, Job, do you know the ordinances of the heavens? What are the ordinances of the heavens? Job, can you fix the heavens' rule over the earth? What does that mean? How do the heavens rule over the earth? Well, it could be because of the gravity, because the heavenly bodies affect gravity on the earth, especially the moon. Or it could be the seasons. Depends on where the stars are and where the sun is. That will determine what season a person standing on the earth is in. God knows all that. He knows how the stars mesh with the seasons. You don't, Job. Let me go back to verse 32. I left this out. Job, can you lead forth a constellation in its season and guide the bear with her satellites? What are the satellites of the bear? The NIV translates it as the cubs of the bear. Jameson Foss and Brown says the cubs of the bear are the three stars in the bear's tail. Well, I know absolutely nothing about astronomy, so I will assume that that is correct. And we now move on to Job 38, verses 34 through 38. God continues to speak to Job. Can you command the clouds so that a flood of water covers you? Can you send out lightning bolts and they go? Do they report to you, here we are? Who put wisdom in the heart or gave the mind understanding? Who has the wisdom to number the clouds? Or who can tilt the water jars of heaven when the dust hardens like cast metal and the clods of dirt stick together? Job, can you control the weather, basically? Nobody can control the weather. Can you say, clouds, pour water on me? Now, Kenneth Copeland one time famously declared he could control the water, or is actually his wife. She was in an airplane, and she looked at a storm, and she commanded it, you know. She named it and claimed it. But most normal people can't do that. So, Job, can you make a flood of water come from heaven so that you're covered with water? Can you send out lightning bolts? And so the lightning bolts say, here we are, Job, ready to do your bidding. No, you can't do that. Who put wisdom in the heart? That, of course, would be God. Now, the Septuagint has a great translation here. Who hath given the knowledge of weaving to women, or the science of embroidery? That's a strange one. I don't know anything about the textual history there, so I don't know. I doubt you're going to find a translation that goes along with that, however. Who put wisdom in the heart? God asked in verse 36. The word for heart in the Hebrew is uncertain. According to the NIV note, the NESB has innermost being, so we'll just take it as heart. Who put wisdom in the heart? That just means in people's heart. Or gave the mind understanding. That's God. All these smart people think they know everything. Remember, God put the wisdom in there. And compared to God, our human wisdom is just about as comparable to a gnat. A gnat's wisdom is compared to us. Verse 37, who can tilt the water jars of heaven? The water jars of heaven, of course, are clouds. Verse 38, when the dust hardens like cast metal and the clods of dirt stick together. The question is, there's a disagreement here. When does the dust harden like cast metal? Before the rain falls or after the rain falls? Well, there's a split of opinion there. I'm going to give you the pulpit commentator's opinion that God is referring to the hardening of the dirt in a drought before the rain falls. Quote, when by the heat of the sun's rays the ground grows into hardness and the clods cleave fast together, baked into a compact mass, then is the time when rain is most needed. I think that's reasonable. But here is an opinion from from Albert Barnes. And his opinion is referring to the hardening of the dust after the rain falls. So here's the quote from Barnes. The proper idea here is when the dust flows into a molten mass, that is, when wet with rain, it flows together and becomes hard. The sense is that the rain operates on the clay as heat does on metals, and that when it is dissolved, when the clay is dissolved, it flows together and thus becomes a solid mass. The object is to compare the effect of rain with the usual effect in casting metals. If I had to bet my life on which two, I think that Barnes has the better case. It's after the rain falls that the clay becomes hard and the clods of dirt stick together. But again, that's a minor detail. The whole point is, Job, you can't do that. You can't make it rain to make the dust hard. You can't do it. Now we go to verses 39 and 41 of Job 38, and we will be finished with this chapter. God continues to speak to Job. Job, can you hunt prey for a lioness or satisfy the appetite of young lions when they crouch in their dens and lie in wait within their lairs? Who provides the raven's food when its young cry out to God and wander about for lack of food? And of course, those rhetorical questions deserve the answer of, it ain't you, Job, that can do that. It's me, God. Can you hunt prey for a lioness? The NIV has lioness. The Holman Christian Study Bible has lioness. The NASB has lion. I think lioness is the best answer because what God is saying here is, can you go out when a lioness needs food for her cubs? Can you satisfy the appetite of those young lions by going out and hunting prey for that lioness? No, the lioness is going to go get the food, not you. These hungry lions, verse 40, when they crouch in their dens and lie in wait within their lairs, in other words, they're too young to go out and hunt on their own, so they need somebody to bring food to them, and that would be God that does that, not you, Job. Verse 41, who provides the raven's food when its young cry out to God and wander about for lack of food? A raven is known for its voracious appetite. They're always clamoring for food, and little ravens are probably the same way, if not worse. They're crying for food. Well, God supplies them with food, not you, Job. So we get the general idea here in Job chapter 38. That prepares us to go to Job chapter 39 in our next audio, and we will see the Lord continuing to answer Job. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.